turning in your Bible to the book of Jeremiah, I'm going to take a number of lessons from this book. Early in the year, well, late last year and early this year, I had occasion to go back to the book of Jeremiah to study it, really to study it in depth. And, of course, I did one of the lectures down at where Jeff preaches in Exton. But just to study the book and to look at a number of things, and I've kind of gone a little further with that and looked at some lessons that are within the book, some parallels to, you know, just my own personal observation, but parallels I see going on in our own nation, some of the nations in the world around. And so over the course of the next year or so, and I'm not sure how many lessons, maybe a half dozen, maybe 8 or 9, I don't know, but I won't do them all in a row. It won't be a long, drawn-out series. But I am going to spend a couple of lessons, maybe 3 here, in the next few weeks, just kind of doing an overview of the book, just to introduce us to the book, to remind us of what the book is all about, what the prophet Jeremiah is all about. And then, as I said, next year I plan to come back and revisit the book and not to do every verse by any means in it, but to take some lessons from it. So you kind of know where I'm going with all of this. If you're open to the book of Jeremiah and you notice, if you begin to just kind of go through and see how long it is, you can even just take the book as a whole and kind of do it like I'm doing here, and you'll realize that it is quite a long book. It is one of the longest in the Bible, for that matter, content-wise, even chapters-wise. It's divided into 52 chapters. And it's always been considered, or at least I don't know of any time this has ever been different, it's been considered one of the books of the major prophets, as they're called, because of its length. Major in the sense of a lot longer, a lot more there. But it stands out, if you're familiar with the book, and we will familiarize ourselves with it, revisit that anyway, it stands out as one of the saddest. It's certainly one of the longest, but one of the saddest books delivered by God to His people during one of the saddest times. If you're wanting an upbeat book, you want to get all fired up and excited, and you know, you're all feeling good and everything, I don't recommend you go to Jeremiah or Ezekiel and read these books at that time, because they're sad. And the things that are said within them, there is far more hopelessness within them than there is hope. Doesn't mean it's not there. But especially as you're looking at the book of Jeremiah, you are not going to see a positive message delivered by God to His people, in which basically God is saying everything is great. It's not. And so it is a very sad book. And Jeremiah stands out as a prophet whose life is not marked by, as we would consider it, good fortune or good blessing. Just the opposite. Now, why would I choose such a book and go through such a book? For two reasons. One, because I think we need to be reminded of the consequences of living a certain way of life. And when that goes on and on and on, as it did in the time of God's people, it may seem to be without consequence, but in fact it's not. And it serves as a warning. It doesn't mean that the consequences found within Jeremiah have to be the consequences in either your personal life or the life of our nation. But they can be, and they will be, depending on what we choose and how we choose to live our lives. The second reason is this. And that is that even though there is so much sadness and so much that is discouraging about the book, there are a number of things that are said within it of which God promises, after all is said and done, I'm still not abandoning you. You are still my child and I still love you. And so for the Christian who is struggling, and I'll put it like that, not the one who's turned his back on the Lord, but the Christian who is struggling, and whose life maybe has the consequences of some bad choices, God is still saying and reminding throughout this very sad book, I haven't given up on you, don't give up on me. And so he begins to talk to his people as though a father would talk to his children, and in that, there is a lot of hope. Now, if I come back like I intend to do next year and I look at some of these lessons, there will be both sides of all of that, the discouraging as well as the hopefulness that might be found. And certainly to look at it from both God's viewpoint in the present and God's desired outcome in the future. And we'll probably do that. Well, let's go back to the book and just sort of, you know, look at the book, scan it, peruse it as a whole. And I'd like to start by talking about the man Jeremiah. If we look at the life of Jeremiah, it is interesting to me that such a book of such burden would be written by a man named Jeremiah. Now, anytime you see in the Old Testament EL, that basically is the suffix of a name that refers to Elohim, or God the Creator, God All-Powerful. Anytime you see the letters AH, it is basically referring to the Jehovah idea, the I Am idea, the Jah or Yah. And in this case, Jeremiah's name means God, Jah or Yah, exalts. And it's a term, that is the Jeremiah part, is a term that means everything's lifted up, high, exalted. And that is why I say it's very ironic that such a book would be chosen to be written by a man that who bears such a name. You would think it would be something else, a Michael, a Daniel, or something like that. But no, it's Jeremiah, God exalts. He was a priest. If we look at the description given to us, Jeremy read it a moment ago. He is a priest. He's of the tribe of the Levites. He comes from a city that lies just to the northwest of Jerusalem, and that would be Anathoth or Anatoth. It is a city belonging to Benjamin, the territory of Benjamin, and it's a short distance, as I say, from Jerusalem. This Levite was called by God, and I want you to go back with me to these opening verses, and I want to really bear down on chapters 1 and 2 in tonight's lesson. But this Levite was called by God and ordained to this purpose, much like Paul was, if we were to go, and I'm not going to, but you can write down and go and compare Galatians chapter 1 to this, in which his job, what God meant for him to be, as we talk about talents and abilities and all of that kind of thing, God meant for him to be a prophet. And Jeremiah makes the point, if we look at verse 5 again, before God speaking to him, before I formed you in the belly, I knew you. In other words, before you were conceived in the womb into the body you now currently have, I knew you. I knew your personality, Jeremiah. And that's what he's literally saying. And before you came forth, that is to be born out of the womb, I sanctified you. I set you apart. I meant for you to be this prophet. I ordained you or appointed you a prophet to the nations. And so God making a declaration from the beginning of the book, you were supposed to be this guy. So if you ever go through life and you kind of hit the age, maybe where I am, maybe a few years younger for some people, maybe a few years older, but you kind of hit that period of life, am I really doing what I'm supposed to do? Am I the person I'm supposed to be? All of that kind of thing. Well, Jeremiah didn't have to wonder. God is saying to him from the beginning here, and I think we're going to note something interesting in verse 6, but from the beginning, God is saying, you are that guy. You were supposed to be that man. I made you to be that man. I gave you all of the equipment, if you will, to be that man, all of the talents, all of the abilities, etc. He had been called to this mission, really from conception, but if you'll notice in verse 6, this repeating of this to Jeremiah may have come at an extremely young age. Now, when I say young, I don't mean he's 2 or 3 years old when he starts writing the book, but he probably is not 20 either. 20 considered by the Jews to be a full-grown man. He's not that age yet. And so, like as not, we're talking about an 18-year-old, maybe a 19-year-old here or something like that. Notice what Jeremiah says in verse 6. When he responds to God saying, I called you from the womb, he said, Ah, Lord God, I cannot speak, for I am a child. And I don't think that he's saying there, it would be ludicrous to think that he's not able to talk yet because he's still a toddler. I don't think that's the idea. But I don't even think it's the idea necessarily of him being so young, maybe 10, 12 years old, 8 years old, as some have supposed, that he has no idea what to say. But I think it is more the idea that he's responding kind of like Moses. I'm young, and who am I? You know, nobody's going to listen to me. If you come to an 18-year-old, or if an 18-year-old comes to the point, and that was me, I want to preach the gospel. One of the things I struggled with is, who in the world is going to listen to an 8-year-old? Let alone all my baggage. But who is going to listen to an 18-year-old kid? And I found that for a number of years after I started preaching, that while some things were received, et cetera, there were still plenty of people who looked at me just like that. The word for child here is a word that means someone of a really young age. And so Jeremiah is kind of responding back to God, and especially over the course of chapters 1 and 2, when God is very explicit about the message. You know, he's a young guy, and who is he to be going and preaching? But not only that, the message is one that even the oldest or wisest guy delivering it is not going to be popular. People are not going to want to receive that, and yet God is saying, no, you're the guy. I selected you really before you were ever conceived in the womb. You are the guy, and you're supposed to be the guy. And you'll notice, if you will, what Jeremy read for us in the first couple of verses. It tells us about exactly how long his preaching went on. It's just about right at 40 years. If we were to go back to this time of the, whatever it was, the 13th year of the king here, we would take that back to roughly 627 B.C. And if we go down to the sixth month of the reign of Zedekiah and all that, we're talking about basically 586 B.C. That's 41 years, or 40 years as the Jews might count it, but about 40 years. And so here we have a young guy. God comes to him at what? A teenager? Says, I appointed you to this task from before you were born. You're the guy. I mean for you to be the one. And he will begin at a young age, and he will go out to do his job. And by the time he finishes, he will be roughly on the order of my age. And so he'll start young. He'll spend 40 years at it. He will come, and when we see everything sort of come to a climax in the book, he's in his late 50s. He spent his whole life, virtually, doing this job, and we'll see, and you may be well aware of the book of Jeremiah, it won't be a pleasant one. But yet he does the work of God. He's been described, and I'll come back to all of that, but let's go on in describing the man Jeremiah. He's been described by a lot of people, if you read through the book. Some would say he's a very frightened man. Every time God comes to him and says, I've got another hard thing for you to do, he's scared. Some would say that. Some would say, no, it's not that he's frightened, but he's very timid. You know, he's reluctant, and he just kind of shirks back from it. Oh, no, not another task like this. Some would say, well, no, he vacillates. Maybe he goes from being the really strong guy, he's bold, he says what God wants him to say, he delivers the message. God comes back to him and says, I got something else for you to do. And he's like, no, I don't want to do it this time. I was fine with it, you know, a year ago or whatever the time might have been, but not now. I don't want to do it right now. I'm not feeling it right now, as some people might say. I just don't feel it. So he vacillates back and forth. And I believe that you'll find a great debate about that if you start digging into Jeremiah, the man, the book, etc. You'll find people debating exactly what's going on, what emotions are behind it, and truthfully, it may be a combination of all of that. But what you can aptly describe Jeremiah doing throughout the book, the one thing that is consistent throughout the book, even with his initial reaction here to God, I want you to go out and preach this message, and here's what you're going to say. And God just lowers the boom, no pun intended there, but he just lowers the boom from the beginning. All the way through to the end, the one thing that you see consistently throughout the book is that he does not want to, and notice the way I'm going to say this, he does not want to have to say what he has to say. But he's brave enough and strong enough to do it. I've never thought that a hero, a brave person, was someone that didn't care and had no fear within them. I've said to many people, I was even talking to someone this morning after services, I think I know what it means to be a coward. I can look back on my life, the first 11 and 12 years, I never knew anything but being a coward. I think I understand. I was scared of everything. I ran from everything. And every time there was a challenge, I was scared and I ran from it. I think I know what it means to be a coward. And I think I also know what it means to stand up for yourself or to stand up for other people or to intervene and fight somebody else's battles because they can't do it. Now, that's not necessarily hero, but here's my point. There have been times when I've faced the challenge of being beaten up. And I've been scared and I ran from it. I was a coward. And there have been times when I faced the challenge of being beaten up and I didn't run from it. But I want you to understand that doesn't mean I didn't have any fear. I think it is a fool, and someone said it like this a lot better than I can say it, but it is a fool who faces something that you can't win and is not frightened by that. It is the coward who runs. It is the brave person who goes ahead and in his fear stands up to the challenge, but it is a fool who has no fear. And I think that's right. And if I look at Jeremiah, I don't see a coward. I don't necessarily see the uncaring. Well, I know I don't see the person who doesn't care and who has no emotions about what he's doing. I don't see that guy either. Perhaps I see someone that I hope I am, and I hope you are. And that is someone who has to face a lot of challenges in life and very difficult ones. And yet, amidst all of those emotions that would go into facing a challenge that is somewhat overwhelming, if not so, you still go ahead and do what you have to do or do the right thing. And that's Jeremiah. And so as we look at his life, I don't think you can doubt his love, his reverence for God. I don't believe you can doubt his willingness to obey God, even when God ordered him, commanded him to do some of the hardest things perhaps any prophet in the Bible has ever been commanded by God to do. That doesn't mean others didn't do some of the same things, but they did it by choice. And you won't necessarily find God commanding some of these unfair things. Some of these things that go way beyond what he would ask other prophets, even contemporary prophets. And yet God would come to Jeremiah and say, I command you to do this or not do that. We'll mention some of them in just a couple of minutes. But even in those commands, even how hard they are and seemingly unfair they are, Jeremiah still does it. He may say he doesn't want to. I think that's honest. He may say he wishes it was not so. He might say, why me, Lord? And yet he still goes on and does that. That's not unlike a Christian who faces difficult obedience to commandments. We've all known people, I'm sure, who obeyed the gospel. Maybe obeyed the gospel later in life and there were consequences of choices they'd made, things they had done. And to obey the Lord meant to obey some things that to them were hard, seemed to be unfair by God to ask it, and yet their faith said, I got to obey God, regardless. And so Jeremiah would be that example. He'd be that guy. I think you can fairly describe Jeremiah as soft-hearted. We don't see a hard-hearted guy here that God chooses because he has a hardened heart. He doesn't care. God says to him, go do this, go say that. He didn't care. You know, that's not Jeremiah. No, Jeremiah is the person that when God says it, it's like look back at God and say, really? You want me to go say that? Do you know what that is going to do to your people? You know how they're going to feel when they hear that? That's what we see in the book. And if we think that no one ever felt, you know, the brunt of some of these things that God has to say in some of these books in the Bible, all we need to do is read closely Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah is soft-hearted. And there are a lot of times in the book, he's known as the weeping prophet. And so there are a lot of times in the book when God comes to him and says, go say this, go do that. And he breaks down. He cries, he gets through it, he gets over it, he goes and does what he has to do. But he feels all the weight of that suffering. But in similar fashion, as we will compare at the end of the lesson, so did Jesus. So did Paul. We can look at examples and verses that tell us the same thing. So did other caring people. Any of these guys, maybe all of these guys, But many of them anyway are people who cared. And they were soft-hearted. And maybe they were chosen because they were soft-hearted. Never let it be said that a soft-hearted individual who cares about the effects of God's commandments can't be an effective teacher of God. If so, then Jesus would not have been effective, nor the apostles, etc., etc. No, Jeremiah is soft-hearted, and he does cry, and he does break down because of all the hard things that are coming from God. He wanted not destruction for his people, he wanted salvation for them. And I'm reminded of Paul, who makes the statement in the book of Romans, I could wish myself accursed for my people. I don't know that I've ever gotten to that point. I hope I do. I hope I can get to the point where I can look at people who are lost and say, I'd rather it be me that's lost than those people. But that's Jeremiah. He wants salvation. He doesn't want destruction. He, like Paul, wishes himself accursed rather than those who turn from God. And so it's not surprising, and again, we'll explore these comparisons in a moment, but it's not surprising then when Jesus comes to his own disciples in Matthew 16 and says, whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? In other words, here's the human Jesus. Who do they say I am? And the apostles answer back. You see this in Matthew 16, beginning in verse 13. And the apostles answer back, remember Peter especially, and says, well, some are saying this, some are saying that, but some are saying, you're Jeremiah. Because he was very much like Jeremiah. So if we want to look at Jeremiah and we want to say, wow, that guy's a coward. Wow, that guy really has some problems. Wow, that guy, you know, always just crying instead of rushing out there and doing God's bidding. Remember, whatever he was and whatever he was known to be, they saw that in Jesus. A lot of people. So if I'm looking at Jeremiah, I'm not looking at this timid, vacillating, frightened crybaby who can't ever make up his mind and doesn't want to teach the truth. No, I'm looking at someone who reminds people, or Jesus reminds people of him. So maybe it puts a different perspective on Jeremiah. Now, in his life, he doesn't have a lot of friends. And generally speaking, when you preach hard things, you don't have a lot of friends. People don't like you for preaching what's hard. He didn't have a lot of friends, but he did have one close one, and that was Baruch. And I'm not going to take a great deal of time with Baruch, but a particular part of the book, or a view of the book, would be to focus on the friendship between Jeremiah and his trusted ally, friend, guy that never quits on him, Baruch. Interestingly enough, Baruch comes from, you know, Jeremiah's a priest, from the class of priests and so forth, but Baruch is an aristocrat, one of the rich guys of the nation. Lost his name. Josephus. It's been a bad day for that for me. But Josephus talks about Baruch, and he talks about the family from which Baruch came. And he would have been well off. His family, you know, aristocrats. His family, people who worked for and with the royalty. We see his brother, for example, being an assistant, a chamberlain, perhaps a treasurer, or in charge of very important business to the king. And so you got two brothers here. One aristocrat, rich, etc., etc., who chooses the course you probably figure that class of people would choose. And then you have Baruch, and he chooses to follow what most people consider in his day a nutcase. But yet there he is, because it's right, and he sticks by Jeremiah. But I might come back and talk about Baruch at a later time. Again, that's a very interesting study in itself. We look at Jeremiah's life, though, and all of that characterizes his life and his work over the period of about 40 years. And then we come to the end of his life. Jeremiah is a strange book in that you have, again, 52 chapters you read through, and then it just abruptly ends. You're almost waiting for the next chapter, pun intended there. You're waiting for the rest of the story. It's like, man, what happened to this guy? He did all of this. He sacrificed all of that. This great hard times under the campaigns of Nebuchadnezzar come against the people. He's all part of that. And then you reach the end of that, and you don't know what happened to him. And tradition doesn't help us out a lot. The end of his life is never recorded, either in the Bible or outside the Bible, that anyone knows of. It's generally presumed that he did go down to Egypt with some of the people that went there following Nebuchadnezzar's campaign. He did go down to Egypt, and most people assumed he continued to preach, etc., and die there. But other traditions have him being, different individuals, Nebuchadnezzar for one, coming against the Jews down there, a reprisal against them, and taking Jeremiah and Baruch all the way to Babylon, and he's dying there. And others say, no, he died and was buried in Egypt, but he was disinterred, dug up, and buried somewhere else in a grave that, was in secrecy so nobody would ever know. Now, all kinds of traditions that surround him, and I'm not going to get carried away with that, but they have been traditions that have been explored for literally thousands of years. But we go back to the work of Jeremiah, and I do want to go back and notice again chapters 1 and 2. I'm not going to go through every verse, but just scan it for a moment. And if you'll notice here in the beginning of the book, in the beginning here in verse 4, the word of the Lord came unto me saying, Jeremiah said, and we've already read verses 5 and 6, but the word of the Lord came unto me saying, drop down to verse 9, and notice how it says, then the Lord put forth his hand, of course Jeremiah objected and so forth, but the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth, verse 9. And the Lord said unto me, behold, I have put my words into your mouth. Now this is the picture I get, it may not be right. But here is God saying, so forth and so on, Jeremiah saying, wait God, oh Lord God, wait a minute, I'm just a child, I can't. And God kind of sticking out his hand, figuratively speaking, touching it to the lips as if to say, be quiet. I'll put my words in your mouth. You're not going out to try to convince these people as a teenager or whatever it is that you are at the time. You're going out as my spokesman, and you will say what I have to say. Notice verse 10. See, I have this day set you over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out, to pull down, to destroy, to throw down, to build, and to plant. Now I want you to slow down with me for a moment and just consider that verse. Because that's the crux of your message, Jeremiah. Do you hear all of the doom? All of the destruction? You're going to be my spokesman. I'll put my words in your mouth. And you're going to go out as my prophet. And you're going to tear everything down. Look around you at all the nations. And I'm not going to go through all of that historically. Not tonight anyway, if I do in these lessons. But one by one, you can count the nations. And I mean all the way around. You can do a whole big semicircle starting at the top of, almost where Turkey is today and go all the way down into Egypt and even below Egypt. And one by one by one by one by one, you can see how history changes in all those nations. From the beginning to the end of Jeremiah's work. It is amazing to study the history. You're going to go and you're going to be a spokesman. And you're going to be over the nations and over the kingdoms. And you're going to be the one that roots out by my word, pulls down by my word, destroys, etc. You're going to lower the boom, my boom, on all of these nations. But I want you to also look at verse 10 and see to build and to plant. Here is God saying sometimes in life, whether it's the life of an individual, or it's the life of a nation, or the life of the world, what I, God, do is I root out, I destroy, I bring a lot of destruction. It's kind of like Jesus saying, if your hand offends you and your eye offends you, cut it off, pluck it out. That's a lot of destruction. And sometimes it takes that in an individual's life. Sometimes it takes that in a nation's life. Sometimes it takes that in the whole world's life. And I think we can go back in history and see some of those things, not the least of which would have been the flood, for example. But it is not to the end of just destroying. It is not of God just saying, I want to exact vengeance. I want to tear everything up because they deserve it. They do deserve it. But God always has in His message the future hope. Even the end of the world, and I'm talking about Judgment Day, even the end of the world, when God destroys absolutely everything, there is still a future. There is a future in heaven, as we sang about a little bit ago, there's a future in heaven of God's people. So God's message never is without hope. And even this book And this prophet, there's a message of hope. He was ordered by God to prepare himself for this very difficult thing. And as you go on in chapter 1, you see some of the things that he had to do. Look down at verse 17 with me. "Thou therefore gird up thy loins, and arise, and speak unto them all that I command you. And be not dismayed at their faces, lest I confound thee before them." In other words, what is he saying? Your message is going to be one that people's jaws are going to drop. They won't believe somebody is saying this, and they won't believe God has sent someone to say this. Go on with me in verse 18. "For behold, I have made you this day a defense city, an iron pillar, a brazen walls of the whole land, against the kings of Judah, against the princes thereof, against the priests thereof, against the people of the Lord." What's he saying to Jeremiah? "I will be with you, and I will defend you, because you are going to have to stand against everybody." There's not one single person, not one single group of people anyway, that you are not going to stand against, because every single one of them are against me. It's that bad. Notice verse 19. "And they shall fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you. For I am with you, says the Lord, to deliver you." And that's the hope. What is that message saying? What message is being sent to every enemy of God? You go against me, I'll destroy you. You try to fight against me and you go down. But you stand with me, even if you are absolutely teetotally, as we would say back home, alone. And you win. Because I'm with you. Now that's tough. And that's a message that rings to me and to you and says to us, you know, Michael, stand with God. Whatever the world is doing around you, if everybody in the world goes the wrong way, you still go with God. Because God will be with you. But it's going to be hard. You're going to have to divide from the people, obviously, as he's telling him here. Because they're going to all be against you. But notice how far it was going to go. Let me just look at a couple of verses. Look at chapter 16 and verse 2. Because this one stands out in his life. This kind of thing. This is the kind of unfair commandment, seemingly, that God brings to Jeremiah. "Jeremiah, I've got a hard job for you to do your whole life. It's never going to change. Nothing is ever going to change in your life." Can you imagine being a teenager and God coming to you personally and saying that? And then saying things like this. Look at chapter 16 and verse 2. "You shall not take for yourself a wife, neither shall you have sons or daughters in this place." You're not going to marry. You're not going to have children. You're not going to have a life like other people. In fact, turn back a page to chapter 15, verse 19. "Therefore, thus saith the Lord, if you return, then I will bring you again, and you shall stand before me. And if you take forth the precious from the vial, there shall be as my mouth. Let them return unto thee, but you return not unto them." What's he saying there? I want the division complete. If they run away from you, or if they draw close to you, I mean the people, if they come to you, you stand against them. My message is not to embrace them. My message is to say, no, you went too far. Now that's a hard life. So let me get this straight, God. What you're saying to me in the space of about six verses here is, Jeremiah, you ain't going to have any friends. Jeremiah, you ain't going to have any family. And Jeremiah, you ain't even going to have a wife or kids. Now, that's hard. And God would be saying, that's right. In fact, if we go back to chapter 16, notice God wanted this separation between Jeremiah and his people even to this point. Look at chapter 16 and verse 5. "For thus saith the Lord, enter not into the house of mourning, don't go to lament, nor bemoan them, for I have taken away my peace from this people, says the Lord, even loving kindness and mercies." What's he saying in that verse? I don't even want you to attend funerals. Now, I don't see any exceptions there, so that must include his own family even. I don't want you going to the funerals, because I've turned away from them. The things that are going to be said, you're not going to take part in that. The hope that they're going to have for whoever has died, you're not going to have that hope. Don't even go to the funerals. One of the most joyous things we do, Yvonne, would be to go to weddings and all of that kind of thing. And we celebrate life and the beginning of a new life together of a couple. And all the hope that that brings. Jeremiah, you're not to go to any weddings. You shall not even go, verse 8, into the house of feasting to sit with them, to eat and to drink. And he goes on to describe the marriage feast and all that, like Jesus in John 2 attending the wedding at Cana. You don't go to those either. You don't go to wedding feasts. You don't go to funerals. You don't fraternize with the people. You have nothing to do with them except to tell them God's against you. That's hard. And I have to say that, you know, sometimes I think about Jeremiah and I think, man, I would not have wanted God to come to me at 18 years old when I decided to preach and say, this is what your life is going to be like. I don't know if I could have handled it. I don't know if I could have been that strong. I don't know. I'm glad I didn't have to face that. But that's Jeremiah. I said I would make this, and let me do this quickly. If you grab an outline, you can see these comparisons, and you might find this interesting. But throughout the centuries, he's been compared to both Moses and Jesus. Let me run through some of the comparisons. Like Moses, he resists the call from God. And he offers very similar excuses. You can see that in chapter 1 and compare it to Exodus 3 and 4. Like Moses, both of them can very sharply rebuke their own people, and yet at the same time they love their people and they plead to God for their people. Both were prophets, interestingly enough, for 40 years. Both prophesied specifically about Judah. Had a lot to say about Judah, and of course Judah and Benjamin, the southern kingdom. Both came from the tribe of Levi. Remember, Moses was a Levite. Aaron was the first high priest under the law of Moses, of course. But both came from the tribe of Levites, and yet the Levites revolted against both of them. We can see that in Deuteronomy or Numbers. But anyway, we can see that revolt that's led against Moses, and we also see it against Jeremiah in this book at the hands of the priest. Both of them are, you know, in one way or another, cast into the water. We see Moses being cast into the water, and we see Jeremiah being cast into a cistern. And both of them were rescued when they were cast into the water, and the intent was death. Remember Moses as a baby, of course. But when the intention was death, both of them were rescued by a slave. And finally, we see long discourses aimed at the people of God, reprimanding the people of God by both Moses and Jeremiah. So there are a lot of similarities. There are also a lot of similarities, as I said earlier, with Jesus. Both of them particularly weep over Jerusalem. We remember seeing that picture of Jesus. But when they weep over the city, they go on to tell us that it's going to fall and be completely destroyed in the future. Both Jesus and Jeremiah do that. Both condemn the practices of the people in their day, in other words, their contemporaries, and both prophesy that they've gone too far and they're going to be completely destroyed because of all their sin. Both specifically indict the priest as being one of the major reasons for the fall of the people. It's the priest's fault. They're the teachers, and they don't teach the truth. Both of them are accused of treason. Remember, that's the main charge that Pilate picked up on, the accusation of the Jews that Jesus was had committed treason. He was inciting the people against the king. Obviously, both of them suffer persecution. Both of them are tried, and both of them are punished, and specifically for the message they preach. It's not any infraction, moral infraction, or anything like that. It's the message they're preaching that they both suffer their punishment. Both Jesus and Jeremiah teach in many of the same or similar ways. Like, for example, just give you one. They invoke nature. Jesus uses things in nature, animals, places, etc. So does Jeremiah quite a bit in their teaching. Both Jeremiah and Jesus experience extreme rejection, you know, where they virtually are alone. Everyone has turned against him. Remember Jesus in that very sad picture in John 6, "Will you also go away?" Because everybody turned away from it. And we see Jeremiah, obviously, you know, all alone. Everyone has turned away from him. But both are very tender-hearted people. Where that kind of thing might make you cold and hard, and you would hate people for the way they treat you, no, they seem to both become more tender-hearted. The worse the people are, the worse they react, the more they love and the more they feel the sorrow for the people, the hopelessness of the people. So the tenderhearted, they are men of sorrows, as we sing in the song about Jesus. Jeremiah is called a man of sorrows. And both experience that loneliness that comes with what God has called them to do. Both are well aware of having been born to fulfill this purpose. So they're very similar. And you see a lot of similarities. I could go on with that, but I tried to choose about 8-1 for each side. I think that's what I did. If you're here tonight, and you're not a Christian, we look at a story like Jeremiah, we look at a book like this, we look at God's call, and we say, why would I want to be in a group like that? What's attractive about coming to a God who may in turn ask me to do things that I'm not even sure I'm capable of doing? Because what you see in God with Jeremiah, you see God ensuring, number one, that he can handle it. Number two, he never leaves it. And even when Jeremiah doesn't react the best,